Good afternoon. Welcome to the EcoNews Report. This week, your hosts are Bella Waters, Admin and Development Director of the North Coast Environmental Center, and Larry Glass, Executive Director and Board President of the North Coast Environmental Center. The EcoNews Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU, brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, EcoNews. Don't forget, you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. Today, we'll be providing brief snippets of current news that pertain to various environmental topics, such as climate change, fossil fuels, City of Arcata's Village Project, and recycling issues in Humboldt County. So first up, Larry, what's going on with the Village Project?
Yeah, well, this has been very controversial in City of Arcata. There's a lot of passion on the many sides of this particular debate. It sort of came to a head at the last Arcata City Council meeting on the 17th, where it appeared that they were going to make a decision. They wound up not making a decision, but they had a lengthy discussion and debate. And because we have one recusal on the council, we have what appears to be a 2-2 split right now. So with the mayor, Sophia, and Paul Patino appearing to favor the project as it was originally rolled out, and then you've got Susan Ornelas and Vice Mayor Brett Watson, who have questions and reservations about the proposed project. What I think it's interesting for our listeners is that, as near as I can detect, there's nobody really out there that's saying no project at all. Like, nobody's advocating we don't need any more housing in Arcata. Nobody's saying that. But I think there's different visions, it's obvious, in the community now about how we move forward. Some people are wanting to go with the project's vision, which is all student housing in this development. It would be about 600 units, if I understand it correctly. And then there's others, and I find myself sort of leaning this way too, that feel that it should be mixed housing. There should be opportunities for families as well as just students. And I think it makes for a more diverse experience for students when they come to live. So they're just not with a bunch of other students from Los Angeles or San Francisco or wherever. They get to interact with real Arcadians, you know, which right. I think is important. You know, if part of your college experience is interacting with the community that you're going to your university in. So we have a great write-up from our journalists at the NEC, Hannah Sargent, has done, and I'll go through some of the high points. The Arcata City Council met on July 17th to continue a public hearing about the controversial Village student housing project. It was recommended by City Manager Karen Deemer that the council give city staff some direction for next steps in moving forward with the project during this meeting. In the meeting, they heard from representative from AMCAL development firm, the director of HSU's housing department, and many members of the public, most of whom were in opposition to the project. Many had spoken at past meetings as well. Many Arcata citizens have spoken out both in support and opposition of this project since it was first proposed 2 years ago.
Wow.
And that was a surprise to me that it's been 2 years, but it really has been 2 years. In this meeting, the council moved forward towards reaching a decision, but were not ready to take a vote yet. Some council members voiced concern that if they voted that night, it would be a split decision, which would stop the project from moving forward. Councilmember Paul Patino and Mayor Sophia Pereira both seemed on the board ready to move forward with the project as it is, with certain conditions attached that the developer would have to agree to. Councilmember Susan Ornelas and Vice Mayor Brett Watson had reservations about moving forward with the project in its current state. Both wanted to see more diversity in the demographics of the new housing project, among other things. Ornella says she wants to see that. She doesn't want to see the way it's configured in the new project,
where it's all just students.
Brett Watson wants to see changes to the project as well and suggested amending the project to allow students with families to live there with their children and partners instead of it just being students only. which seems very minor but important kind of change.
Mm-hmm.
When asked about opening up the project to students with families, the AmCal representative said that he would be open to discussing it with HSU officials. While the council didn't vote yet at this meeting, they made significant progress towards outlining the conditions they would like to see in the final project and gave the developers and HSU some suggestions about how they can change the project to better suit the needs of the community. Seems likely the city council will support this project moving forward if they get some of the changes they've suggested. The next meeting is set for August 15th, where they will continue the public hearing and discuss next steps. So hopefully, in the meantime, we will get an outline of what changes are being proposed ahead of the meeting so that those of us in the public can make informed contribution to their discussion.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hope for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are we hearing from the NEC members about this project? Just a lot of questions.
A lot of questions. A lot of concerns that there is a need for housing, but not sure if this is the project that necessarily will meet the needs.
Right.
So, yeah.
And I've heard concern from some folks that have contacted me that they're concerned that the parking situation in that particular part of town would be exacerbated by the development as planned.
Right.
So there may be that the council needs to take a look at that. I mean, it's nice to try and plan for a world without cars, but we're not there yet.
No. I also heard that the rents for these places are going to be in the $900 to $1,000 range,
$1,300
range.
Yeah, that's what I heard as well.
Which I don't know how any student or really families can afford that when they're also going to school.
Yeah, that just add to the student debt load, right?
Oh, gee.
To borrow to pay your rent.
Right.
All right.
Next up, Gay LeBaron wrote a bit of a nostalgic piece in his latest article, Great Redwood Trail Proposal, A Worthy Idea, published in the Press Democrat earlier this month. Gay's article states that State Senator Mike McGuire, whose district includes the proposed 300-mile route of the Great Redwood Trail Act, can get almost poetic talking about the beauty of it. McGuire says, I have to say, this is a once-in-a-generation opportunity. So few times in our lifetimes do we have a chance to see such a thing happen. Gay goes on to continue that lifetime is too brief to describe how long it's been. The Redwood Trail proposal comes as another great idea. The first one, which has made all the difference, is the Save the Redwoods League. The league is celebrating its 100th year, an anniversary that honors the foresight of a group of busy-bodied women in a lumber town and five very important men who heard their plea. The article goes on to provide a history of the Save the Redwood League and the Northwest Pacific Railroad, which followed the Eel River north from Willits. Built in 1914 to carry lumber from the northern mills through rugged, beautiful country east of the chosen highway route, it has had the distinction of being one of the most, if not the most, expensive railroad lines per mile in the West. The current owner of the railroad line, the North Coast Railroad Authority, runs freight now from Willits south. The route of the proposed Great Redwood Trail would be the right-of-way for those resting tracks through lands that are near wilderness with large ranches stretching eastward. You may have read last month about the proposed sale of the Dean Witter Ranch that has more than 16 miles of river frontage along that track. The Redwood Trail legislation, as McGuire proposes, would end the railroad authority, shift the Willits South freight line to Sonoma Marin Area Rail Transit, and create a shorter, less daunting echo of the Pacific Crest Trail with a kayak option as well. The Railroad Trail proposal not only acknowledges the loss of the timber industry, but offers what can be a new chapter. McGuire is clear that his trail proposal is not just for nature lovers and exercise addicts, but that there is an important economic element. McGuire added that this could be a big part of a conversion from a timber economy to recreation, reminding Gay that outdoor recreation is currently closing in on being a $100 billion portion of California's economy. The senator goes on to say that this is a start of a multi-decade project, and he says, we have to do it right, not fast. As of the airing of the show, SB 1029, the North Coast Railroad Authority Right-of-Way Great Redwood Trail Agency Bill has been passed unanimously through the Committee on Transportation and recommended to the Committee of Appropriations. But what we've been hearing is that Governor Brown needs to hear from everyone who's interested in the trail to fund it. That is the holdup right now.
Right. And that is the big issue. So reach out to your governor and let him know that you want to see this project funded, because it's going to take a bunch of money to undo all the missteps that have happened in the past with the Rail Authority.
Right. Yep.
All right. Well, the next story of great local interest is recycling, which is where the NEC started many, many, many years ago. And there's some changes. Our intrepid reporter, Hannah Sargent, has ferreted out the facts here, and let me run through this with you. Following the introduction of a new policy in China earlier this year, much of the world is experiencing an extreme recycling crisis. As of January 1st, China put a ban on foreign imports of various types of recycled paper and plastic, and severely tightened restrictions on recyclable materials that they would accept. And just to clarify, China has been the dumping ground for all of the waste products of the West for a long, long time. Those materials that they will still accept now must meet a strict 0.5% contamination standard, which waste management organizations have stated it's nearly impossible to achieve. So that's one of the dirty little secrets about recycling, is that when your recycling item is contaminated, when it gets to the end user, they don't want it. So you may be feeling real good about yourself throwing that thing in the recycling bin, but if it's contaminated in some way or other with foodstuffs or with other items in it, staples in the cardboard or whatever, it makes it unusable at the other end.
So are you saying I have to wash my plastic containers before?
Well, I'm actually at the point now where I'm trying to figure out how to not even have the plastic containers in the first place. But I admit that's a challenge, even for me. If not, I'm a real sort of anti-plastic person. But, I mean, it's everywhere, and it's hard to avoid them. But that would be the first thing, would be prevention. It's always the best cure. But yeah, if you're going to have plastic containers, you need to thoroughly clean them so that they're not contaminated and getting into the stream and then making all the rest of it unusable. So this poses a huge problem for systems all around the world, as China was formerly the number one global importer of recyclable materials. Many waste management companies have scrambled to search for other importers to take recycled goods. Unfortunately, in many places, recycling processes have been completely put on hold. In a recent article in the New York Times, many small-scale recycling companies in Oregon and other Western states have had to resort to dumping tons of recycled material straight into the landfill as the foreign markets that had previously absorbed the recyclables have closed up. So that's the dirty little secret right there. We think we're doing all this great recycling, so we really do need to avoid even using the plastic in the first place, because realistically, at least at this time, you can't recycle it. So how does this affect recycling in Humboldt County? What's going to happen to our recyclable materials after they leave our driveways? Due to the short time frame of this show, we can't get into all the details, but you can look into the further details on our website. We do have time for us to let listeners know how they can help reach that 0.5% contamination standard. Many recyclable materials that are collected and processed will ultimately not end up being recycled if they contain high levels of contamination. If they're not pure enough to be considered valuable in the global market, many of our recycled materials will end up in the landfill anyway. Because it's extremely important to take steps to reduce the level of contamination in these materials that you recycle, There are a few easy steps to do this. First, look at the recycle label on containers you dispose of and determine if they're in fact recyclable at all. Because if the plastic isn't stamped, it's not recyclable.
Mm-hmm.
Avoid throwing materials in the recycling that are not recyclable, especially things like plastic bags, diapers, and wrappers. I mean, people do that.
Right.
People think
diapers are recyclable. They're not.
Empty and rinse out containers to remove food and other contaminants before placing them in your recycling bin. Further, because our curbside recycling programs collect a single stream mixed recycling, it can also potentially result in higher levels of contamination than you'd find in dual stream recycling systems. As you recall, we used to have multi-stream recycling at one time.
Right.
You remember driving into the recycling center there, and there would be like 20 different bins to put your various things in.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to what was considered the more cheap and efficient single stream. But in reality, it's only cheap and easy on the front end, not on the back end. So while China's ban on recycling imports is only making things even more difficult and uncertain, there are really many obstacles to truly recycling and repurposing the waste that we produce. If we want to ensure that we aren't sending more materials to the landfill, we ought to first focus our efforts on waste prevention and resource conservation. There's a whole lot of stuff that shouldn't even be run through the recycling process, insists Margaret Gaynor of Zero Waste Humboldt. And she was the founder of that group, with vast knowledge of the local recycling system. It should be avoided in the first place. See, we're on the same wavelength.
Yes.
All right. Well, that's the story of recycling. So, like we said, look onto our website for further details of that.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're going to move on to a segment of climate change news. There seems to be in the last 3 or 4 weeks, there's been a lot of developments on the climate change front. The Keystone XL controversy is ramping up again. The company building the long-contested XL oil pipeline notified the Cheyenne Sioux River Tribe in a letter this week that it will start stockpiling equipment along the pipeline's route this month for preparation of construction. The tribal chairman, Howard Frazier, sent back a sharp one-line response, "We'll be waiting." The Cheyenne River Tribe has opposed the Keystone Pipeline since it was first proposed in 2008 and is seeing how the pipeline protests can play out. Just north of the tribe's land in central Dakota, protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline drew international attention as thousands of demonstrators established a semi-permanent camp starting in the summer of 2016 where the pipeline would cross under the Missouri River just upstream from the Standing Rock Indian Reservation. The Cheyenne River Tribe helped fight that pipeline and is in a similar geographic situation now. Its reservation is just downstream where the XL pipeline would cross the Cheyenne River. Like Standing Rock, the tribe fears a tar sands oil spill from the pipeline contaminate its water. So here we go again.
Here we go again.
So this is, you know, this is something that Trump said one thing about on the campaign trail, and then he got elected and totally turned on the people that were protesting that, and as we saw, with violent results.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an interesting thing. That also was from Inside Climate News Organization, written by Phil McKenna.
Okay.
In a story that we got from GRIST, which is an environmental news service that I got first turned on to a long time ago by our founding father, Tim McKay. He was the one who turned me on to GRIST, and I've been following it ever since. But they have an interesting story written by Eric Holtis, and it's Trump and Putin are clearly in cahoots, but over fossil fuels, not necessarily over the thing that you were thinking about.
Right.
During a joint press conference with Donald Trump in Helsinki on Monday, Russian President Vladimir Putin went a long way towards answering why. "I did want Trump to win because he talked about bringing U.S.-Russian relationship back to normal," Putin said. That statement was widely covered. something else Putin said during the press conference is more important. I think we as a major oil and gas producer, and the United States is a major oil and gas producer as well, should work together on regulation of international markets, he said. We do have the space for cooperation here.
Yeah, that wasn't talked about much.
A chance for both of them to make a bunch of money. So I still want to see Donald Trump's tax returns to see what connection there is between the Russian Arctic oil projects that have been had the way cleared for them. So some close observers have drawn this connection before, but it's worth saying again explicitly, there's no way to understand Trump's relationship with Russia without putting oil and climate politics in the center. If you're upset at Trump and Putin for undermining our democracy, just wait till you find out how they're likely colluding to destroy our planet's climate system, too. Russia is a petrostate, and the U.S. is becoming one, too. In fact, the two countries are the world's largest non-OPEC oil producers, extract nearly as much as OPEC countries combined. They also own even a greater share of the global natural gas market. Added together, the two countries produce six times more natural gas than the rest of the world. By working together, they can keep the global economy swimming in oil and gas. What's the primary force working against the fuel industry these days? Climate activists. It's not difficult to see that Trump and Putin alliance's deliberate attempt to delay action on climate change. Consider these moves. Trump's promise to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord was specifically designed to weaken the agreement and the spirit of cooperation. Trump's move to open up offshore oil drilling in the Arctic will help both U.S. and Russia access rich oil fields and in an increasingly ice-free environment. Trump's steel tariffs on Europe will help bolster Russia's pipeline-building oil and gas industry. Trump's claims that by purchasing natural gas, Germany is being controlled by Russia is a window into the vision of a fossil fuel-driven geopolitics. Trump's buddying with North Korea might even be designed to clear the way for a Russian gas pipeline there.
Keeps so, piling up,
lots
doesn't
of
it?
Food yeah. for thought in that. And meanwhile, Igris also reports, the same author, that over the past 15 years, the National Weather Service has called for an impending El Nino in their July outlook six times. They've only been wrong once in 2012, and they're calling for one again.
Mm-hmm.
If this building El Nino arrives, the global air temperatures will surge, lagging a few months behind the warmer oceans. That will give 2019 a good shot at knocking off 2016 as the warmest year on record. With a strong El Nino, global temperatures might even tiptoe across the 1.5 degrees Celsius mark, temporarily crossing a major milestone that climate campaigners have been fighting to prevent. El Nino has been blamed for the massive wildfires, crippling droughts, and global food shortages, and is looking increasingly likely that another one's on its way. The latest outlook from the National Weather Service out Thursday said there's a 70% chance that El Nino will arrive before the end of the year. Summertime outlooks for El Nino are pretty accurate, so it's a big deal when that weather pattern is forecast. Another El Nino would carry far-reaching consequences for the world's weather, one of which may have already arrived. Hurricanes and typhoons have been popping up more often than normal this year. More specific, both in place-specific names, you know, it's called a cyclone in some parts of the world, a typhoon in other, and a hurricane in other. They're all the same beast.
Mm-hmm.
El Nino warms the waters of the Pacific Ocean, providing additional fuel for tropical cyclones and increasing their activity by about 15%. So that's something to look forward to.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And here's an angle that a lot of people haven't put together.
I was surprised to read it.
This was also from Grits. This one was written by Greta Jockum. Yeah, I guess that's the way I would say it, too. So, you know, every day we log on to the internet and we don't give it much thought. It seems magical and intangible sometimes. But the reality is you're relying on physical concrete objects like giant data centers with miles of underground cables to stay connected. All that infrastructure is at risk of being submerged. in just 15 years. Roughly 4,000 miles of fiber optic cables in coastal U.S. cities could go underwater, potentially causing internet outages. That's the big finding from a new peer-reviewed study from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the University of Oregon to figure out how rising sea levels could affect the internet's physical structures. Researchers compared a map of internet infrastructure to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's predictions for sea level rise near U.S. coasts. And also, Humboldt County, along the whole West Coast, is the most vulnerable to rapid sea level rise.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're subsiding already.
Right.
And then with the ocean rising on top of that. So then, jumping right on to the same theme here, this is from Bob Weber of the Canadian Press. Out of 1,773 glaciers, 1,353 shrank significantly between 2000 and 2016, says glaciologists. Ice floats in the Slindry Fjord outside the Eureka weather station, not our Eureka.
No.
On Ellesmere Island, Nouvant, on July 24, 2006, new research finds that hundreds of glaciers in Canada's high Arctic are shrinking and many are fated to completely disappear. The recent statistics published in the paper say that hundreds of glaciers are shrinking and they're breaking up into smaller icebergs. And so it's creating this city of icebergs, they're describing it as. So lots of little ones through the ocean, which also creates more hazards for shipping as
right.
they spread out into the ocean. So I thought it's another sign of...
Right. Well, do you have any good news, Larry?
Well, there is some good news in the sense that more Americans are accepting the realities of climate change than ever before. They don't agree on what's causing it, but they're finally 73% of them are accepting it, which is, I guess that's some good news.
I guess so.
Did you want to talk about coastal cleanup?
Yes, I did. So with all this news of plastic pollution and changing weather, sometimes people wonder what they can really do. And the difference is, you know, just doing little tiny things every single day can add up to a big contribution. One of those is Coastal Cleanup Day. So the NEC is gearing up for our 39th annual Coastal Cleanup Day in September. And did you know that Coastal Cleanup Day had its humble beginnings right here in Humboldt County as a program of the NEC called the Beach Beautification Project? It is now an international event. We're looking for business sponsors and more site captains to help out. We clean up over 80 beaches and bring out over 7 tons of trash in one day in 3 hours with over 700 volunteers. So if you're interested in finding out how you can help with this event, join us August 7th from 6 to 7 p.m. at the NEC office at 415 I Street to learn more about Coastal Cleanup Day and putting together your own team. We also have a Coastal Cleanup Day kickoff party on August 30th at Lost Coast Brewery from 5 to 8. Grab a beer and listen to some tunes while learning about Coastal Cleanup Day. Every pint goes to supporting NEC programs. All right, so this has been the Eco News Report with Bella Waters and Larry Glass, and we've been your hosts for the past half hour. You can find more information about the issues we've discussed on the NEC website, which is www.yournec.org. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the public affairs page on the KHSU website at khsu.org, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air. Previous shows are posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 826-6089. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Join us again for the next Eco News Report.